A phrase commonly heard in modern Christian circles is, "Jesus is your friend." It's a phrase that is sometimes meant to bring closeness and comfort to lonely and insecure people who want a buddy, or even in some sense a lover, to make them feel special, needed, and wanted. We see this sentiment expressed in some of today's worship music. For example, the lyrics from the worship song, "I Want to Lavish" by David Harper, goes like this: "You call me child, and I'll call you father. Kisses from heaven of joy and laughter. I want to lavish my love on you, Jesus." Now, in my view, these words express an inappropriate sense of physical and emotional intimacy that can tend to lower Jesus to the level of next-door neighbor, or worse yet, boyfriend. But a far more worthwhile question than, "Is Jesus your best friend?" is, "Are you a friend to Jesus? What are you prepared to do for him? And how faithful are you as a friend? How committed are you to what was important to him?" This Easter, I will explore the theme of friendship with Jesus, especially in light of the fact that when he hung on a Roman crucifix for us, his friends were mostly nowhere to be found. Let's look at a few points as we look back to the initial meeting, the initial calling between Jesus and those who became his disciples. First of all, we need to understand that the disciples were not instant friends of Jesus. He's not gathering a group of previous associates to join his club. We don't really know why he chose the specific individuals that he did. What was his criteria? What was he looking for? It's unlikely that it was a complete random selection as he walked along the seashore and through town and just pointed and said, "You and you two and you, follow me." Those he invited to join him were called to be students, same word as disciple. So why do they agree to suspend their pre-existing careers, leave it all behind, and follow Jesus? As Jesus begins his ministry, he calls his first disciples, Simon Peter, Andrew, James, and John, to follow him, and he says, "I want you to come with me to fish, not for fish in the lake, but to fish for people." Simon and Andrew leave the mending of their nets. James and John leave their father, and all four begin to follow Jesus. The next day, Philip and Nathanael believe they have found, quote, "the one who Moses spoke about in the law." Next, Jesus calls Matthew, Thomas, James, Simon the Zealot, Thaddeus, and finally Judas Iscariot. Jesus is called Rabbi, which just means my teacher, 63 times in the Gospels. The duty of any rabbi is first and foremost to teach the Torah, that is the law contained within the first five books of the Old Testament. He would train his disciples to emulate him, any rabbi would, and even surpass himself in knowledge and practice of the Torah. The rabbi was obliged to protect his disciples from heresy and from sin. And so for this reason, the rabbi had the privilege to reprimand his disciples where necessary and to judge their actions. Normally, disciples would actually choose their own rabbi based upon their particular interest in the rabbi's perspective on the Torah. But in the case of Jesus, it was he who chose his own followers, not because of their suitability based upon their level of righteousness, but quite the opposite. I think Jesus picked a group of average, common men who could be representative of all flawed and weak men and women throughout history. The disciples of Jesus committed themselves to obeying him as rabbi and even to, if necessary, suffering for his name's sake. We see that in John 12:26, where Jesus says, "Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servants, my students, my disciples will be also." This is fundamental and crucial to this developing relationship between Jesus and his disciples as they become friends. Let me repeat that. Whoever serves me will follow me. He's not saying we'll follow the church that I set up. He's not saying we'll follow a creed or a set of doctrines. They will follow me. So they need to know me. They need to know what I'm saying, what I stand for, what's important to me, and follow that. And where I am, my servants, who will become my friends, will be with me. Being in every sense of that word. Next, Jesus spent approximately 3 years with these disciples. They ate together, they slept together, they faced false worship together, adoration, rejection, and hostility all together. But note that there's nothing suggesting that the disciples were single. It is more likely that they were married young men, because that was the norm. And they may well have had children. There's nothing stating that the disciples were with Jesus 100% of the time of that three-year period, or that they never went back home and spent time with their families, or even continued to work at times. Thirdly, students become friends and then ultimately evangelists. Near the end of his ministry, it's clear that a very strong bond had developed between Jesus and his students. For the most part, a deep trust and respect had emerged that went beyond the master-disciple relationship. They seemed to enjoy each other's company on a social level, and they had bonded in the way that a group of soldiers in combat might become brothers in arms. In John 15:14-15, he says, "You're my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants. For a friend doesn't understand what his master is doing. They're just following along and taking orders." He said, "You're more than that to me. I have called you friends because everything I've learned from the Father I have passed on to you and shared it with you and held nothing back." Next, despite their familiarity with Jesus, the disciples repeatedly failed to understand his message about what Messiah means, what the kingdom is, what he was saying about God, and what his revelation about law and grace was. And it's not their fault. If you or I had been there, we also would have misunderstood, because our understanding today is colored by hindsight. We know what Messiah meant because of what happened when he died. But before that, you wouldn't have understood either. I wouldn't have understood. But what's important is that when the gospel writers say that the disciples didn't understand Jesus, they were actually saying these things for every future friend of Jesus. They were saying that it is very easy for you or I to misunderstand his central message, even though the message is crystal clear. Because most student-disciple friends will overlay what Jesus said with their own creed or culture or personality or our own wishes and dreams of what we hope he's saying or wish he was saying. As might be expected with any group of close friends over time, jealousy and competition are clearly evident among the disciples. I love this famous passage in Matthew 20, verse 20, where it says, "The mother of Zebedee's children," that's the mother of the disciples James and John, "came to Jesus with her sons," sort of slinking behind her coattails, a little nervous, kind of peering past her, hoping it's okay. "She got down on her knees before Jesus to ask him something, and he said, 'What do you want?' She said, 'Would you mind saying that my two sons, may sit one on your right side and one on your left side in the kingdom. Well, that's just an ambitious mother talking, isn't it? Just kind of wanting the best for her kids. Wrong. She was clearly acting as their mouthpiece because they were too afraid to ask Jesus themselves. And like most mothers, she would want the best for her kids, but she would more likely want to speak on their behalf to ensure a better outcome for them. Matthew 20, verse 24. Then the other 10 followers, the other disciples, heard what James and John's mother had said, and they were angry with the two brothers. Note, they weren't angry with their mother, because they knew it was James and John that were behind this. They were the ones who were asking the question through their mother. And their thought was, how dare you jump the gun? Because they also probably had the same idea. I wonder who's going to be next in charge. It probably should be me. I'm the most experienced, or I'm the eldest, or I'm the strongest, or I'm the biggest, or I'm the one with the best education. And Jesus called and said to them all right, calm down, everyone. He said, you know what the kings of the nations show their power to the people by? Important leaders use their power over the people. And that's what you're all wanting to do. He said, it must not be that way with you. Whoever wants to be great among you, let them care for you and for each other. Whoever wants to be first among you, let him be your greatest servant. Jesus recognized that internal struggles for preeminence among his friends would only lead to division and destruction of his mission. Next, we see a failure of the friends of Jesus to stay with him when he's praying in pain. Remember what I said earlier? Jesus wants us to be with him, to be attentive to him, to be connected to him as a friend. On the night of the Last Supper, Jesus identifies that he will soon be betrayed by one of his friends. Now, friends don't do that, do they? Friends don't betray each other. The writer of the gospel here is clearly saying they weren't really being very good friends. Now, friends don't do that. Jesus tells the assembled group of disciples in Matthew 26:31, this very night you will all fall away on account of me. None of you will be good enough friends. None of you will be real to the bitter end friends. You'll all abandon me. And we're very familiar with Peter's betrayal, but did we remember that all of them betrayed Jesus? They all failed in their friendship. Peter famously replies, even if all the other friends fall away on account of you, not me. You know, they're all weak, and they're not real friends, which probably suggests that I should be in charge of these other weakling disciples. But I am your real friend. I will never fall away from you. Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And then it says, and all the other disciples said the same thing. I will never betray you because I'm your friend. I'm a good friend. It doesn't matter how rocky it gets or how much risk there is to me personally, I will never betray you. Immediately after this, Jesus went to Gethsemane to pray, to prepare for the pain and the shame he was about to endure. And he told his friends, stay here and go while I go and pray. He was saying, be with me. Maybe I'll be over there a few feet away from you, but I need you here knowing that you're with me. In other words, be with me, support me. Your presence will give me comfort and strength in this most difficult time. It says, Jesus said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. So stay here and keep watch with me. Maybe you've had a time where you needed a friend just to listen, just to be there, to share the burden or the pain that you're experiencing. And if you're trying to share this most difficult, intimate, painful moment in your life, and they're like checking their phone, or they're wondering what the scores are for the Flames. Oh, they lost again, it seems. And you know they're not with you. They may be bodily around, but you long for a friendship that is more committed than that. Matthew 26:40, then Jesus returned to his disciples and found them all asleep. Couldn't you men, he says, keep watch with me for 1 hour? This happened a second time. And finally, who stood with Jesus at the crucifixion scene? Who was there to give support and encouragement? None of his disciples. None of his male friends. Matthew 27:55 to 56 tells us who was at the crucifixion scene. Many women were there, watching from a distance, because they wouldn't have been allowed to stand right underneath someone who was on a crucifix. Many women, just women. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. Where were the men? Where were the guys? Where were the 3 long-year intimate friends, committed friends who just a day earlier had said, "No matter what, I will die rather than abandon you"? We'll leave the rest of that story for another time, but we see in the first few chapters of the book of Acts, interestingly, that the fear, the timidity, the guilt of the friends of Jesus are replaced with boldness and with confidence to be his witnesses and to continue a new phase of his ministry. And the exclusive reason for this new boldness and confidence is the powerful infilling of the Holy Spirit. What does Jesus expect of you and me as his friends today? 3 things. Closeness. Jesus is not just a friend when we need something, when we're lonely or afraid or unsure. Let his resurrected life live in us at all times. Secondly, understanding. We need to really know why he came, why he died, and why he lives again. And separate that from religion, from church. Why did he come? Why did he die? Why does he live again? He came to bring revelation, to light the way to the Father, to introduce the highest law, the highest ethic even behind the law, the eternal aspect of the law that the law itself could not produce, which wasn't any rule or commandment. It was simply love. He died to be a representative sacrifice for all humanity, to reveal the hatred that the Father has against all sin, not because he's an angry God, but because of what sin does to his beloved creation. And he died to show the seriousness of that sin and to point people to the offer of grace and forgiveness of sin, as well as the invitation to step into a new dimension of creation life, the Spirit-filled life. And he lives again as our elder brother, as our friend, as our intercessor, and as our Lord and Master. And I would say he is still our rabbi today. And third, Jesus wants faithfulness from his friends. Our obligation as a friend to Jesus is to maintain the simplicity and purity of his message, to never allow any diversion or perversion of his voice to bring people back into the bondage of legalism or institutionalism. We must be faithful to the urgency of Jesus to draw people into a direct relationship with God instead of building the walls and barriers of religion. And we need to be aware of cultural and societal pulls that can seek endlessly to discredit the message of grace and love.